You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
America's national debt stands somewhere near $15 trillion today. And although when he was vice president, Dick Cheney once claimed that deficits don't matter, anyone who's been listening to this year's political talking points might beg to differ. Simon Johnson, MIT professor of entrepreneurship and former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, also disagrees with Cheney's assertion. And he and University of Connecticut law professor James Quack have co-authored a book about how and why America's accumulating deficits matter a great deal. White House burning, the founding fathers out, national debt and our national debt and why it matters to you is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it has brought Simon Johnson back to our show today. Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay. Dick Cheney's full quote was, "Reagan proved that deficits don't matter." Was that a reasonable conclusion based on the facts of the time?
No, it wasn't a reasonable conclusion, but it was a political moment that he was speaking about. And it is true that many people, including people on the right, have been able to defer dealing with the deficit for decades.
Until
now.
Today.
Well, yes, I think today is a good time to deal with it. But frankly, the politicians would also like to kick this can down the road again.
Is the kind of thinking that Cheney was engaging in what's landed us into our current situation in regard to budget deficits and this huge national debt?
Yes, a big part of what's changed in American politics is that people on the right who used to care a lot about deficits and debt, Eisenhower, for example, absolutely represents that tradition. Bob Dole represents that tradition. That has really shifted towards what you can call the Newt Gingrich moment. Gingrich, currently proposals a big increase in deficits and debt as part of his presidential campaign. And he's been on these ideas for more than 30 years.
So you say he really changed things around when he was the Speaker of the House?
Well, Gingrich is absolutely present throughout this moment. Ronald Reagan first tried, although Reagan actually ended up raising taxes in a deal.
And the debt ceiling more than, I think it's 12 times or something like that.
That's right, yes. That's a long tradition of raising the debt ceiling. But Reagan raised taxes as part of a deal with the Democrats in the 1980s. Gingrich attacked the Republican leadership for that. He attacked Bob Dole for doing that deal. He pushed hard for these ideas when he was Speaker. But the real tipping point came when George W. Bush was president. Gingrich was out of office. But then the Republicans controlled the presidency, the House, and the Senate.
It seems strange that only 12 years ago politicians were debating how to use surplus revenues. Was that just a product of the 90s boom? And I was thinking about that 90s boom, a boom that had been fueled to some degree by a couple of economic bubbles.
Yes, it was. It was definitely unsustainable. It was part of the boom, and it was a mistaken analysis, let's say, that led people to think too much in terms of surpluses. Those surpluses were not real in any lasting sense, and that led to some very big mistakes, including the Bush tax cuts.
You write that if the American people understand where our national debt came from, the stakes involved, and the trade-offs involved in reducing the debt, we will be able to choose the future that we want for our government and our society. That suggests that we're unclear on just what deficits in the national debt are.
I think we're unclear about what the government does. 40% of people who draw Social Security, a pension, think they don't participate in any government program. About the same for Medicare. These are not just government programs. These are the quintessential government programs. And these are the big money items in terms of federal government spending.
And that's why people in the Tea Party who want to shrink the government don't want anybody to touch their Social Security or Medicare.
Yes, there are not just some amazing quotes about that. It actually, when you look at the opinion polls and you look at the in-depth interviews, you do find that people on the right in the Tea Party identifying with very small government are not fully aware to the extent to which they participate in government programs.
Now, how linked are the deficit and the national debt? Does the national debt include accumulated interest on the sum of the previous deficits?
Yes, absolutely. The debt is a stock. Think of the debt as being the water that's in your bathtub. You're adding new water. That's the deficit. Some water is going out. That's, you know, if you were running a surplus. But it's the stock of what's in the bathtub. That is the national debt.
And where are we today? Is the bathtub about to overflow?
The bathtub is definitely getting fuller. It's the numbers in terms of U.S. government debt held by the public, not intragovernmental debt. That's an accounting issue, an accounting device. But it's $10.8 trillion. That's about 73% of GDP. That's a pretty high number. About half of that is held by foreigners outside the United States. We should be paying attention to this.
Well, we were shocked when we learned that when Greece joined the Eurozone, it had 100% of its GDP in national debt. But we're at 73%. That's pretty high, isn't it?
It's not the red zone. It's not a fiscal crisis at this moment. You don't want to slam on the brakes. You don't need to do precipitate, inappropriate austerity. But you do need to get a grip on it. You do need to use it, I suggest, as a window of opportunity. And letting the politicians say, well, we'll deal with it later when we've done some other things that we want to do, that is not a good idea. That is what they want to tell. That's what they tell you because that's what you want to hear. But right now we should be thinking about taxes and revenue as well as controlling spending.
Well, this whole thing goes all the way back in our history. You place a great deal of importance on the war of 1812 in the history of the national debt. Was that when the process began?
Well, the process really began at the War of Independence when the Continental Congress wouldn't pay for the army, and George Washington and Alexander Hamilton were very frustrated. And the post-independence period was very tough in terms of the national budget and the credit system. It just didn't function. The Constitutional Convention fixed that. Alexander Hamilton fixed that. But the War of 1812 was still a disaster. It was still a catastrophe from a fiscal point of view because that system was not yet fully established. And it was the salutary lessons that were learned from the catastrophe, including when the British burned Washington and burned the White House. The way the political elite reacted to that gave us a new consensus that lasted a long time and served us well.
You note that Congress was forced to relocate from Philadelphia to Princeton, New Jersey at one point because they couldn't afford to pay our soldiers. Has Paul Ryan suggested something similar in his new budget bill, perhaps moving Congress back to Philadelphia to save a couple of bucks?
No, he hasn't got to that one, but he is suggesting a pretty dramatic change in Medicare, in how you provide for people's health care when they're in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's a big shift in what the government will do, and I think we should have this. We're opposed. We don't support Mr. Ryan's proposals, but we want to have that debate, and that's a big reason we wrote the book, to really get into those details.
Some people argue that Madison set us on a dangerous path when he increased the national debt and borrowed, but you think that beginning to borrow money from other countries was a good thing. Why?
Well, it depends on the opportunity that presents itself. Thomas Jefferson, of course, made the biggest foreign loan in the 19th century for the Louisiana Purchase. Now, that was a brilliant strategic move. That really allowed the United States to expand westwards. It was also a lot of money in its time, but he got good terms on it because the U.S. had established a strong credit record.
You discussed the link that already existed between military power and money. Did Britain have a powerful military because it also had a powerful economic system at the time?
Yes, and particularly it had strong financial markets. It had a strong public credit. The government was able to borrow primarily because it had the democracy. The parliament was representation for the merchants and for the burgeoning middle class.
But France had a larger population, had wealthier people, and yet Napoleon pulled it together for a while, but was the French system more flawed than the British system?
Yes, the French system before 1789 had less legitimacy, less representation. They could get some revenue, but they couldn't ramp up when they had a confrontation with the British. That was a big British advantage.
So what did we model ourselves on, the British or the French approach?
The British approach. Alexander Hamilton actually was criticized by many of his peers for being too oriented towards the British, and that was part of the fight that Jefferson on the one hand and Hamilton on the other hand had. And part of the reason we had a crisis in 1812 was a lot of people rejected the Hamilton system until they realized its value in the confrontation with Great Britain.
I mentioned earlier that when Greece adopted the euro back in 2001, the national debt hovered around 100% of their GDP. Was that unusual?
It was high in the day. And remember, the Greeks were also disguising or hiding apparently with help from Goldman Sachs and some other people, the true nature of their debt. But there was a view in Europe at that time that this kind of debt was okay, it was manageable and wouldn't get out of control. In retrospect, that was a mistake.
Well, they were also having trouble collecting taxes, weren't they? Hasn't that been part of the problem there and in Italy as well?
There is certainly plenty of tax evasion in Greece and in Italy, but they take more in tax revenue relative to GDP than we do. These are relatively high tax economies, and we are not proposing to move at all in that direction.
What's Greece's national debt in relation to GDP today?
Well, they're in the around 120, 130%. The forecasts are that under their current agreement programs with the IMF, it'll go up 140, 150% before coming back down to 120%. They're going to end up, after 10 years of austerity, being a highly indebted country. It's not likely.
And higher than they were when they entered the Eurozone.
It is not likely to prove a sustainable set of policies.
My guest is Simon Johnson. He's written with James Kwak, K-W-A-K, by the way, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. The book is published by Pantheon. Stay with us for more. We're back with Simon Johnson, who's Ronald A. Kurtz Professor of Entrepreneurship at MIT Sloan School of Management and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, co-author with James Quack, an associate professor at the University of Connecticut School of Law, of a new book called White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. It's published by Pantheon. You wrote a post for the New York Times economic blog this morning where you called both Representative Ryan's and President Obama's views on the federal government's budget dangerous. Dangerous in different ways, I assume, but what makes them dangerous?
Well, I think Mr. Ryan's proposal is dangerous because it goes too far and too fast in the wrong direction. You don't need the kind of austerity that he's proposing. That's not where we are as a country. That's not where we are, even if you take the debt seriously, which we do. I think President Obama's ideas are dangerous because he's not explaining to people what the government does. 40% of people, as I mentioned, who use Medicare don't know they participate in a government program. How can you have any sensible discussion about taxes that you should pay if you don't fully understand what the government does and why it does it? You just get confusion and a complete political morass out of that.
You say that accepting the programs of Medicare and Social Security, the government would have been smaller by about a third since the 1950s. So our government is really shrinking? I mean, does Grover Norquist know this? Isn't he the guy who said, my goal is to cut government in half in 25 years to get it down to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub?
Yes, Grover Norquist did say that, and he is, of course, the leader of the anti-tax wing of the Republican Party. The government has shifted massively in terms of what it does. After World War II, when the federal government expanded, it was more about a military presence and a global role. People remarked that it was a large army with an insurance company attached to it, the insurance company being Social Security. Now it's the other way around. The federal government runs a large insurance company, Social Security and Medicare, with a relatively small military relative to historical levels compared to the size of GDP, relatively small military attached to it. You have to understand what government does. Why do we have Social Security? Why do we have Medicare? What is Social Security average payment is $13,000 a year. I do not recommend that anyone bet that is enough to live on indefinitely. But it's there as a form of insurance, as a safety to fall back on when you are old, when you have outlived your other resources. Medicare is the same principle. Before Medicare, nobody had private health insurance when they were 85, 90. If you abolish Medicare, you won't get it back. It'll be about your money and your family's money. That's all you have to go on.
Well, we have this growing national debt, and still it's difficult to see how it affects the living standards of the average American. How long will we have to wait for it to catch up with us?
Well, that's the big question. And, of course, I don't know. And nobody knows. And that's what the politicians rely on. Right now, the bond markets are favorable. Interest rates are low. And any rational, calculated politician says, why should I propose something that's potentially unpopular and will lose votes as opposed to borrowing some more money from our own people or from the Chinese? At a 2% interest rate, they're going to defer dealing with this. But the problem is the bond markets turn against you rapidly when you have too much debt. You don't know when that's going to happen. And then you'll be forced into the kind of austerity that you see in Spain today or in the United Kingdom today. Extremely disruptive, damaging to the economy, then it comes back and really hurts people.
Well, comparisons are often made between an individual accruing debt and government debt, spending more than you earn. But isn't there a big difference between when a family and a government defaults on its debt?
Well, there's a huge difference between family finances and country finances.
Actually, why do politicians always say that? You know, I was told that if I build up a credit card debt that I can't pay back, that I'm doing something wrong. The government does it all the time.
Well, the politicians are obviously playing their own rhetorical games. I would suggest think about the parallel of companies. Many well-run companies have a considerable amount of debt that they continues for the life of the company, doesn't bring the company down as long as it's well managed. The danger is if you're relying on debt financing, you're not bringing in enough revenue, and the debt is rising relative to the future prospects of the company. It's like that with countries. Countries can have a sensible, smart debt strategy. We used to have one in this country. The Alexander Hamilton principle is run up the debt when you need it in a time of national emergency and bring it down subsequently, but bring it down slowly, gradually, in a less painful way.
A listener, James from Manhattan, asks, doesn't the significance of the deficit depend on a lot on how the money is spent? For instance, wouldn't spending more on education have benefits and an impact far exceeding the actual dollars because It gives us skills for the marketplace plus intelligence.
Certainly, the value of what the government does depends on how you spend the money. Absolutely. Our point is you should finance it with tax revenue. If you have a national emergency, if you have a massive financial crisis, the bottom drops out of your tax revenue. That's when you use the debt. But if you're talking about education investments, that's what you should be focused on in terms of value. Why should the government do it? Why isn't the private sector doing it? Why can't individuals do it for themselves? But then finance that with revenue. That's the key. Don't assume you can use deficits and debt to run that kind of activity on a day-in, day-out basis.
So you're opposed to the Bush tax cuts?
The Bush tax cuts, in retrospect, were a mistake, and they will expire at the end of this year. Our very strong recommendation in the book is don't renew those tax cuts. Don't renew them for anyone. And honestly, this is an unpopular message. It's unpalatable in Washington, but that's the way we see the fiscal situation, the economic situation.
Well, it's only unpalatable with one party right now. We have this polarized situation. And although I think the public has come out in support of higher taxes for the wealthiest Americans, that doesn't seem to be having much of an impact on the political process.
You're right that the public is leaning towards supporting higher taxes on the wealthy, but the Bush tax cuts didn't just affect the wealthy. They got disproportionate gains, it's true. They also affect the middle class. And when I say don't extend them, I'm saying don't extend them for anyone. President Obama is proposing to extend them for people who earn less than $250,000 a year. I don't think you should do that. So both parties are going to disagree with and no doubt try to completely ignore or brush aside the arguments we put forward in this book. But we're arguing for really dealing with these fiscal problems, for really explaining to people what the government does and why it does it and funding that properly.
What are your objections to President Obama's suggestion?
Well, we think that the taxes, if you want the revenue, the problem is this is a middle class, or problem of a feature of this, a great strength of this society.
Is $250,000 too small to start taxing at?
Yes.
Should we start at a million or a half a million?
No, it's the other way. Everyone who benefited from the Bush tax cuts needs to have their taxes go up. I'm sorry to say that. I know it's not going to make me very popular. But if you look at the amount of revenue that you would bring in, realistically, not in some pie-in-the-sky world, but realistically, what does the Congressional Budget Office say you can bring in if you tax at different levels? Just going after the wealthy is not going to help you bring the budget under control.
Well, I know, and when I look at this debate and I think about who should be taxed, since I don't feel like I have a lot of money, I always think that the level should start a little higher than I earn.
Everyone feels that way. I've spoken to some audiences already in New York this week, and I've had very good resonance and reactions. And then I say to them, okay, who would like their taxes to go up? And there is a stony silence. That is the heart of our problem.
You quote President Eisenhower as saying, should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again. And then he went on to call the fringe groups that believed in doing away with these things stupid. Yet, aren't many members of his party proposing to make major changes in just those areas? And nobody's calling them fringe.
It's not fringe. It's become mainstream thinking.
What happened?
The Republican Party shifted massively. There was a tax revolt that started perhaps a little bit in the 1960s, definitely in the 1970s. Ronald Reagan represented this when he came to office. But Reagan, in modern terms, and the Republicans have been discussing this week, would be regarded as hard to get through the primaries, potentially, because he was a compromiser. And he was willing, ultimately, to raise taxes. So did George H.W. Bush.
And yet they have suggested putting Ronald Reagan on Mount Rushmore.
They want to have it both ways, I suppose.
You also say that prolonged debts can hurt economic growth and that this could be especially dangerous for the country as we're slowly emerging from a recession. How does governmental debt affect economic growth, which relies on the health of the private sector?
Well, the government debt has a big impact on interest rates. If people are worried about the solvency of your government, this is the case in Greece, for example, but also Portugal, Spain, Ireland, and now Italy, that will push up interest rates. That affects everybody's ability to borrow. We, of course, don't want overborrowing. We've experienced that in the 2000s. But you need a reasonably well-run credit system with reasonably low interest rates. And this was part of Alexander Hamilton's insight into the functioning of economics that was right in the 1770s, and it's right today.
Many politicians say that if we continue accruing massive deficits, we're leaving it for our grandchildren to pay the tab. You explain that that isn't necessarily the case.
Absolutely. So if you manage the debt, if you stabilize it, the economy continues to grow, this is not generating burden for our future grandchildren. It's a question of what is your debt strategy? Do you use it day in, day out? Do you rely on it To fund your deficits on an ordinary basis, and that's where we've come to in the past couple of decades? Or do you use it just to buffer big international shocks, wars, for example, other emergencies, financial crises? Then it can be absolutely part of responsible economic management.
A recent op-ed piece in the New York Times pointed out some of the loopholes in the tax system, like fees that fans pay to get better seats at sporting events. And according to the column, tax expenditures cost the government about $1 trillion a year. What impact does that have on the deficit and the national debt?
Well, it obviously increases the deficit and pushes up the debt. And tax
why aren't those loopholes closed? I mean, paying an extra, you know, being able to write off fees that you pay to get better tickets seems to me the sort of thing that is pretty easy to address.
Absolutely. In economic terms, I couldn't agree with you more. And tax expenditures are something we focus on in the book and talk about how to eliminate them. But I have to tell you, every one of those has a constituency supporting them. People in Washington have formed the idea that somehow this isn't spending. It is spending. It's spending through the tax code. And as a result, it's very hard to make progress on those. But part of the negative reaction we've had from the left of the political spectrum comes when we say that the mortgage interest deduction should be limited and capped. That's a tax expenditure. It's a pretty big one. It also benefits a lot of people in the middle class.
What about farm subsidies?
Again, well, those are more directly subsidies. Typically, those are government spending. You should look at the value you're getting
from them. Some
people
have said that they've led to the growth of agribusinesses and hurt small farmers. Do you agree?
I'm sure we can find instances when exactly that has happened. Again, we need to go through what the government does, why it does it. Farm subsidies bother a lot of people. They're not what drives the debt and deficits in the biggest way. That is overall tax revenue. It's also the social insurance programs.
You've called your plan a conservative fiscal plan. Do you think that many of today's leading conservatives will see it that way when they read the book?
No, I think that they will say they represent a true fiscal conservatism. But today we have this bizarre situation. A man like Newt Gingrich, who's been arguing that he's a fiscal conservative for three decades, his proposal right now before the Republicans in the primaries would increase debt to GDP to about 150%. That's up to Greek levels. This is Newt Gingrich arguing that that's the right way forward. And the scoring comes from the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget. It doesn't make any sense that the right, I'm afraid, has lost its compass on deficits and debts. And we're trying, with a lot of respect and a lot of care and attention to their history, to encourage them to come back towards the middle on this.
But you're also being critical of the left in this.
Absolutely.
Where are they making their mistakes?
Well, I think that there's a couple of mistakes they're making. First of all, they're not emphasizing enough and explaining what does government do and do you want the government to continue in these kinds of programs that are also not leveling with you enough on the tax revenue. So when President Obama says we can just do what we need to do by raising taxes on people over 250,000, again, with a great deal of respect, I disagree with that analysis. We think that the Bush tax cut should not be extended for anyone.
Simon Johnson and James Kwok have written a book called White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. It's published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks very much.